An indefinite stay. What's next for death row inmate Rodney Reed, who had been set to be executed on November 20th? We'll have the latest and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Also, once sleepy counties on the edge of our biggest cities starting to boom, the changing face of the Texas suburbs. Also, a holdup at the police station? Why some say law enforcement agencies are preventing vulnerable immigrants from getting special visas designed to get them out of harm's way. And a large Catholic diocese wants to provide foster care services without penalties for LGBT discrimination. All those stories and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 18th day of November 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. A topsy-turvy weekend on many fronts, wouldn't you say? The Baylor Bears suffering their first loss of the season, this to the Oklahoma Sooners, moving the latter up to number 8 in the AP poll, dropping the Bears back to 13. The Aggies moved into the top 25 at number 24, while the Longhorns fell out thanks to a last-second loss to Iowa State. Other news from the land of topsy-turvy, Kim Kardashian's husband making an appearance at Joel Osteen's Lakewood Megachurch on Sunday. But a couple of days earlier, he performed to much smaller crowds at the Harris County Jail. Kanye West doing two unannounced concerts there, bringing his dancers who wore scrubs to give them the look of inmates, the Houston Chronicle reports. West said he considered the concerts at the jail a mission, not a show. His latest album is titled Jesus is King, which the rapper describes as an expression of the gospel. Speaking of Kim Kardashian West, published reports say she was meeting with Texas death row inmate Rodney Reed on Friday as he received word that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted him an indefinite stay of execution. Reed was set to be executed on the 20th for the 1996 murder of Stacey Stites. But Kardashian West was among many celebrities and politicians who had recently taken to social media and to the streets, calling for Reed's execution to be at the very least postponed. Well, now what? Joining us is Amanda Marzullo. She is Executive Director of Texas Defender Service, a nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to people facing the death penalty. Ms. Marzullo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
On Friday, the state's Court of Criminal Appeals, the highest criminal court in the state, halted Wednesday's execution. This seemed to come as quite a surprise to a lot of folks. Why was that?
I think because folks were focusing on the executive branch at this point. The Board of Pardons and Paroles, just a few hours before the CCA's decision was released, recommended a reprieve for Rodney Reed, which is pretty extraordinary. This is only the second time in the past decade or so that the BPP has recommended clemency for a death row inmate.
Why has this case garnered so much, not just attention here in Texas, but nationally, indeed internationally?
In a nutshell, I think it's because of the evidence of his innocence that has gone without relief. There are a lot of cases out there where there are questions, but in this case, there's a lot of evidence demonstrating not only that he didn't do it, but that someone else did.
For more than 20 years, Reed has maintained his innocence, and this new evidence that you're talking about seems to put suspicion on her fiancé. What is his name, and why is he now considered a possible suspect here?
His name is Jimmy Fennell. He was kind of always in the list of potential suspects. He was the prime suspect from the beginning. Some of it has to do with his own testimony and medical examiner timeline. So he testified at Reed's trial that he spent the evening alone with Stacey Stites. But now new examination of the crime scene and her body has said that she was murdered during that time period. His own criminal record, he was subsequently convicted of kidnapping and rape during his time as a law enforcement officer, and that the couple had a volatile relationship where he often even threatened to kill her if she was unfaithful.
And that's kind of crucial here, because something we haven't mentioned yet in our conversation is that it appeared Reed had been having an affair with Stacy Stites, and Stites was engaged to wed Jimmy Fennell.
Exactly. And that's actually how he ended up being connected to the case, is that his DNA was recovered from her body. And the sort of the linchpin of the state's theory against him was that, you know, what they recovered was intact sperm. And they said that sperm only remains intact for 24 hours. So it had to be essentially deposited around the time of her murder. But since the trial, every expert that testified, either they recanted that testimony and said, no, it's actually 72 hours, mm-hmm. or the agency that employed them recanted that testimony and said it was false.
What happens to Reed at this point? I mentioned he's been behind bars for more than 20 years now, about 20 years, actually, since Stacy Stites' death was in 1996. So what happens now to his case?
It goes back down to the trial court for further review. The court's order, or the CCA's order, directed them to look at three issues. So one of them is whether he's actually innocent. Another one is whether Jimmy Fennell testified falsely at his trial, and if so, did that affect the outcome? And then the third is whether his rights under Brady, which says that exculpatory information must be provided to the defense, mm-hmm. was violated because law enforcement officers in the area knew that they had such a volatile relationship.
Amanda Marzullo is the executive director of Texas Defenders Service. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Nearly 20 years ago, a new type of visa, the U visa, was created for immigrants who were victims of crime. The idea was to get people in ongoing situations of danger out of harm's way. To qualify, immigrants must have been the victim of a violent crime and have been helpful in a police investigation. Now, to apply, immigrant crime victims must first go through a local police department in the U.S. and obtain certification. But a new report by the Center for Investigative Reporting found police leaders in states, including Texas, may be blocking certification. CIR reporter Laura Morrell is the author of this investigative report, and she joins us now to talk about her findings. Laura, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Give us an idea of how often this U visa has been used in the past.
So, as you mentioned, the U visa has been in place for about 20 years. And what I found after 10 months of looking at this issue is that the U visa is used very differently across the country. There are some areas where police departments have standardized written policies that sort of guide them in how they consider these requests and the criteria that they look at. And then there are other places that don't have that, and it's a very unofficial process.
You were looking at some of the raw numbers, too, and you know, in terms of how many of these were issued, and you noticed a change in 2018.
So I looked specifically for a few agencies. I looked at their certification totals. For instance, in the Miami Police Department in Florida, they had only certified about 27 cases in the last 3 years, even though they got 235 requests. So their denial rate was about 90%.
Among the law enforcement agencies that you looked at here in the Lone Star State, did any stand out?
Yes. I reached out to the McAllen Police Department, and they told me that they actually don't consider these kinds of requests, that they defer everybody to the DA's office, which is a problem because if you have victims whose cases never resulted in an arrest, they're out of options if the McAllen Police Department decides not to certify. There were also a few DA's offices, the Tarrant County DA's office, for instance, told me that they only sign off on closed cases, which is an issue because if you have a case that's taking months or even years to go through the criminal justice system, you have this victim that's, you know, likely waiting for a long period of time to get this relief that they're entitled to.
It's important to underscore that the police departments involved here, they're not approving visas. It's just that you have to clear this hurdle before you can actually be considered for a U visa. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's actually a misconception that I think a lot of law enforcement officials have. You know, if you sign off on this form, you're granting this person status. And that's not the case at all. This form is just one of many documents and pieces of evidence that victims have to submit in their application to the government for this kind of relief.
But what I think a lot of people may be interested especially in is whether or not there has been a change in the willingness on the part of law enforcement agencies to play their part in this U visa process. If we are seeing something happening within the past couple of years, some kind of change there.
So it's actually that part of my reporting was a little bit hard to get at, right? Because agencies don't have to provide a reason when they decide not to sign off on these requests. But one thing that I did hear from sources that I talked to is that they suspect that the anti-immigrant sentiment that's becoming more mainstream in the country might be a factor in this. Another factor, of course, is just the lack of education about what the U visa is. I had a few agencies when I reached out for comment that told me that they couldn't help me because this was an immigration issue, and I had to explain to them what the U visa was and how it works. So I think there's a lot of varying reasons about why there's this resistance from law enforcement.
Laura Morrell is a reporter covering immigration for the Center for Investigative Reporting, and we are going to link to more information on this story at texasstandard.org, or you can go straight over to reveal.org. Laura, great to talk with you. Thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Standard.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hi, David. The sudden developments regarding the planned execution of Rodney Reed, that Texas inmate who has long maintained his innocence, generating a lot of reaction on social media. Yes. As you explored, David, Reed first received a 120-day stay of execution from Texas Pardons and Parole Board, then had his execution halted by the State Court of Criminal Appeals. On our Facebook page, Jonna Blackley says, "All of those who've worked for this must be elated, not to mention Mr. Reed himself. Now, perhaps we'll get an answer as to why the state refused to perform DNA testing on all the available evidence." And Jamie Shimkus says, "I've been following this case for 10 years. It has always been problematic in terms of no conclusive evidence of Reed's guilt, but since the original trial, much more information has arisen, including retraction of the medical expert's testimony, so there is definitely too much uncertainty to proceed with execution."
One of the things that's really interesting about this is how much attention this has received just within the past, I would say, 2 or 3 weeks, actually, from a lot of people getting on social media. You know what you need to do, Texas? You need to reach out to us on your favorite social media platform and tell us what's making news in your part of Texas. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, is looking for you, and he'll be back in about 35 minutes or so with more of the Talk of Texas. The Standard continues in just a moment.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas is not generally known for its public health policies. Indeed, what we most often hear about Texas is its number one ranking for uninsured residents. Yet, a new survey by a nonprofit examining the health priorities of local governments places San Antonio and Dallas among the best big cities in the nation. Texas Public Radio's Joy Palacios reports.
For the last 3 years, City Health has been tracking attempts at improving public health in the 40 most populous cities in the country. Its president, Shelley Hearn, says they track 9 different policies.
Are they able to access high-quality, nutritious food? If someone is sick, can they stay home from work or take care of kids who are sick? Are you being protected if you're a young kid from the dangers of tobacco?
City Health awards medals ranging from bronze to gold. San Antonio and Dallas are 2 of 8 cities nationwide to earn gold. They join Boston, Chicago, L.A., New York, San Francisco, and Seattle. Both Dallas and San Antonio ranked high on recently enacted paid sick leave policies, pre-K programs, smoke-free indoor air, and complete streets. Over the last 5 years, San Antonio has put emphasis in several of these areas. Kathy Shields is San Antonio Metro Health's Interim Assistant Director for Community Health.
These are areas that health departments across the country and cities across the country should be tackling if they want to see improved health.
City Health says there are areas for San Antonio and Dallas that need improvement. San Antonio is in the first year of its affordable housing plan and received no medal for that category. Dallas received a no medal designation in healthy food procurement. Dr. Philip Huang is the director of Dallas County Health and Human Services. He says there's been a push to identify accessibility to healthy food.
The other thing with, you know, healthy food access, this again gets into some of the basic, you know, determinants, the basic needs that we need to address for the long term to address some of these disparities. South Dallas, Southeast Dallas need to have the same access to healthy foods that other parts of the community have.
Each of Texas's major cities were ranked. Austin, Houston, and Fort Worth all received bronze medals for their health policies. El Paso received no medal. I'm Joy Palacios for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. What used to be called the American dream is more easily found in some places than others, of course. Generally speaking, it's just tougher to afford a house with a backyard or to operate a small business in a big city these days. Just ask the thousands of folks turning their backs on Houston for the outlying suburbs. It's a migration pattern that's changing the face of many once sleepier counties like Liberty, Brazoria, Montgomery, and the like. Joining us now to tell us more, Erin Douglas. She's a local economy reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Erin, thanks for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the folks who are moving to these areas outside of Houston. Who are they by and large?
Yeah, so by and large, these are young, diverse families. They are highly skilled. They're highly educated. And they're looking for a little more room to spread out. They're looking for an opportunity to start their own business, sort of moving into the next stage of their lives and, you know, trying to provide a little bit more stability for their families. And they're doing that in the suburbs.
Is a lot of this, I mean, I mentioned the cost of living there. I would imagine that's the key factor.
Yeah, but it's also a mix of factors. So it's the cost of living. It's also the schools. There are some really good school districts in the suburbs. Specifically, I talked to folks in Pearland, just southwest of Houston, mm-hmm. and most of them were really interested in these better school districts. They were also very interested in these master planned communities where they had a lot of amenities. They had a little bit more space to spread out. So it's a mix of factors.
You know, I was thinking about how the suburbs have traditionally been considered as sort of bedroom communities, right? You'd move out a distance from the city, but you'd mm-hmm. still have that commute and you've got the traffic and all that sort of thing. Is that what we're seeing in some of these more rural counties, or are we not sort of seeing a sort of large scale economy sort of sprouting up along mm-hmm. with this population growth?
Yeah, so that's one of the key questions here is how quickly some of these smaller cities outside of Houston can build a job base and can grow enough businesses there to support all these families moving out there without having to commute into Houston. So right now, from the folks I've spoken with, a lot of them still view places like Pearland as a bedroom community commuting back and forth. However, that appears to be sort of on the beginning of this shift here in which, you know, they're getting more corporations, more companies, more small businesses to just locate there rather than asking their folks, hey, like you could commute in from Pearland, we'll be in Houston. I think that more companies are starting to locate outside in the suburbs for some of the same reasons, right, that the families are going.
But because it's easier to run smaller businesses in some of these less populated counties, is that the idea?
Well, not less populated, but it's easier for the cost of startup. You need the population growth to attract the businesses, right? Mm-hmm. You need the population growth in order to have a workforce base, in order to have customers, et cetera. So I think as these outer counties get more populated and they're growing really, really fast, they're growing at rates of like 2 or 3%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, mm-hmm. but it's huge year over year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think as they get more populated, more companies will see that this is a sustainable place to have a business.
I'm wondering, though, because this is clearly going to change the demographics of a lot of these outlying counties. How are people in general feeling about these changes coming to counties like Liberty and Montgomery and Brazoria, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it depends on who you ask. So some of the newer folks, I spoke with some immigrants, and they said that it wasn't really easy to move in a community with little diversity when they first got there, mm-hmm. and that people were sort of skeptical of them. They weren't really able to get a lot of business at first. However, as the community has become more diverse and bigger, they feel a little bit more welcome. Now people greet them at the grocery store. Their child's classes have become more diverse. On the flip side, when I talk to some of the older neighborhoods that have been there for decades and decades, you know, they're sort of mourning a loss of a sense of identity in their once small farm town. And so I think it's just a natural tension that arises in that. You know, they want to keep it small. They don't want to be a big city. Yeah, I think there are some tensions. A lot of residents told me that there's sort of an east-west divide in Pearland, which is where I kind of focused the story. We'll have to see if that rectifies itself or if they just continue to sort of live in a divided economy, a divided city, sort of.
Aaron Douglas has the full story for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to it over at texasstandard.org. Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A new poll from the University of Texas at Tyler finds most Democrat and Democratic-leaning voters in the state remain undecided on their party's U.S. Senate primary. No candidate is getting double-digit support, and all are within a couple points of each other. UT Tyler political science professor Mark Owens says more than half of those polled still don't know who they'd pick to challenge Republican Senator John Cornyn.
Neither of the candidates in this case have held statewide office prior, right? We've had a couple candidates. One candidate has run statewide, but each of the others have run in sections of their state.
The top candidate in the poll is longtime community organizer Christina Sinsun Ramirez with 9.4%, but that puts her less than a point ahead of former congressional candidate MJ Hager. A former Army lieutenant from North Texas convicted of war crimes is a free man after getting a full pardon from President Trump. Clint Lawrence spent the last 6 years in prison at Fort Leavenworth for ordering soldiers to open fire on unarmed Afghan civilians in 2012. On Fox News Channel today, Lawrence lashed out at the highest ranks of the armed forces when asked if his pardon undermines the military justice system.
Anybody that's got to be confirmed by the Senate for a promotion, they're no longer a soldier, they're a politician, and so I think they lose some of their values, and they certainly lose a lot of the respect from their subordinates when they do what they did to me, which was, you know, throw me under the bus.
Trump pardoned Lawrence and two other servicemen convicted of war crimes on Friday. Texas health officials are urging people to get vaccinated against the flu after confirming the first child death of the 2019-2020 flu season in the state. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie reports.
The 5-year-old lived in Harlingen and tested positive for influenza A last week. Their death brings the total number of pediatric deaths for the 2019-2020 flu season nationwide to 3. The child was not vaccinated. San Antonio Program Director for the Immunization Partnership, Cherise Rohr Allegrini, says if you haven't gotten your flu vaccine yet, it's time.
Get it now. It takes a week to 10 days for it to become effective. Basically, it's never too late until after you've had the flu.
The Texas Department of State Health Services says flu activity across the state right now is above average and recommends everyone over 6 months of age get a vaccination. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Three special runoff elections to fill vacant seats in the Texas House of Representatives will be held January 28th. Governor Greg Abbott announced the date Saturday. The races are for House Districts 28 and 148 in the Houston area and House District 100 in Dallas. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. With the rise of the word foodie, one might be tempted to believe that the careful planning of meals is a rather modern phenomenon. But a recent discovery near Mexico City certainly belies that. Indeed, it debunks our understanding of how prehistoric people planned their meals. Joining us now from Mexico City is archaeologist Luis Cordoba Barradas. He is with Mexico's National Institute of History and Anthropology, which goes by the Spanish language abbreviation INA, I-N-A-H. Dr. Cordoba Barradas, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Gracias.
So I gather work was being done for a waste containment site when these bones were discovered?
Sí. Se iba a construir un relleno.
Yes, when they were digging, they found the mammoth bones.
What kind of bones were they, and how many were found?
During the first dig, they found 10 or 15 bones, but now we are up to more than 800.
More than 800 bones. What gave you a sense that you were looking at something historic here?
Well, because we realized that these were man-made pits dug by prehistoric hunters to trap the mammoths.
What was previously believed about how mammoths were captured by early humans?
We used to believe that one hunting technique included scaring the animals into natural depressions, such as canyons, but here it is clear that hunters coordinated the creation of these pits.
So this is a real breakthrough, and it says something about how early hunters would try to gather their food, that they were thinking in advance enough to dig large pits to capture prey?
Yes, you can tell by the trap's measurements. They're about 5 feet deep and about 75 feet wide. So far, we've discovered two pits, but we believe there are many more. We can see this as a long strip.
This sounds like a remarkable undertaking, especially given that we're talking about a period, 15,000 years ago?
About 14,700 years.
What would it have taken for groups of people to dig these sorts of traps for woolly mammoths? We should note, of course, that the mammoths were about the size of elephants. So to get the equivalent of 14 elephants, those have to be huge pits.
Absolutely. It clearly shows they were well-organized, hardworking people who knew the region very well. We can even say they used the traps for long periods of time.
How much was mammoth meat a part of the diet of people in that region back 14,700 years ago?
We believe they must have eaten many types of animals. This region was rich in horses, camels, bisons, mammoths, but the pits show they specialized in mammoth hunting.
I wonder, as an archaeologist yourself, what this tells you about civilization in that region those many years ago.
We know these were small groups of people of between 20 and 30. But many of these small groups must have converged in this region because they organized to dig these traps. Another thing we learned is that they used mammoths as more than food. We found some tools made of mammoth bones, and we also know they used the hides.
But it sounds like one of the most important and significant discoveries here is that people were far more organized, far more socialized than perhaps previously imagined.
Yes, there are other places where mammoth bones have been found. Europe comes to mind, Ukraine, Siberia. But these were found in natural traps, not man-made ones. This required high levels of organization.
Would you say that this marks a kind of turning point in your understanding of the peoples of that region?
I think so. Plus, this is the first time we have found so many skeletons in one place. We have found 1, 2, 3 at a time, never 14.
So what happens next? What happens to these bones? I presume they will stay in Mexico, or what exactly?
Well, in 2016, we found one mammoth in this place. This region is called Tultepec, and the community here created an exhibit at its cultural center. This will grow that exhibit.
This is a really exciting finding. Archaeologist Luis Cordoba Barradas with Mexico's National Institute of History and Anthropology, which goes by the Spanish language abbreviation INAH, I-N-A-H. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. We'll update you as we learn more.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you so much.
Gracias.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard, and I'm Alex Hopes, founder of Zilker Bark. The way that Zilker Bark came to be a Austin staple for dog lovers. I love my dog as much as I love you. It really began with me moving to Austin with my dog Sid. I visited Zilker Park and I immediately fell in love. I bought a camera I couldn't afford and I decided I was going to start being a photographer with a social media as a compliment. So I love my dog as much as I love you. My dog Sid, he got hit by a car. And it was about the most challenging thing that I'd had to deal with at that point in my life, and probably still to this day. Sid had a little Instagram account for himself that was about 20,000 followers, and I remember dreading even telling anybody what had happened because I was just so devastated. But I'm so fortunate that I did, because there was this huge outpouring of support from that community, and they actually raised almost $10,000 in 2 days to pay for his vet bills. And it ended up saving his life, but we were at this point where we didn't own anything. We packed up my car and we drove around the country for 6 months. And during that time, I took lots of photos of him. And Zilker Bark was the project that I wanted to start, because I knew how much those photos meant to me and I knew how much it would mean for others. One of my favorite things about photographing dogs is the faces that they make in between that people would hate to see of themselves are the ones that we love the most. It's the one where you catch a dog with the lip caught on the upper tooth or the tongue sticking out of the mouth. I just love the openness to anything a dog does being cute. I love my dog, baby, I love my dog. I'm Alex Hopes, and this is the Texas Standard.
We are coming up on 43 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Monday. Hope yours is off to a good start. For over a decade, Texas illegally denied special education to tens of thousands of kids with disabilities. State lawmakers took action, federal monitors stepped in, and that sort of thing. But now, 3 years after this issue first came to light, Texas families say they're still being delayed and denied access to special ed in the Lone Star State. Today, we kick off our investigation from the Houston Chronicle and Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee.
We start in Brazoria County, south of Houston, where Carolinda Acevedo gets settled in her new classroom. It's actually her family's dining room.
So this is my PE stuff. So they sent me a ball, and then they sent me some jump ropes. And then down here, like, there's...
She pulls out a microscope, some science tools, all neatly organized in a cart.
Yeah, and then up here are all my books.
Every morning around 8, she logs onto her laptop and connects to 8th grade at this new online school. Last year, going to class in person filled Carolinda with anxiety.
A lot of times when I'd be stressed and I try to take a test, I would end up, like, flunking it.
Her mom, Christina Acevedo, saw other red flags during 7th grade. Her daughter's mood disorder and anxiety kept her from learning. She'd stay up late doing homework, but then did poorly on state exams.
I knew that she needed help.
But after Acevedo asked the school to test Carolinda for special education, Brazosport school staff said she didn't qualify.
I feel like my requests for help were kind of falling on deaf ears and being delayed, and I was just sort of getting the runaround when really my daughter just needed the support.
The school staff declined to comment for this story. Carolinda's mental health got so bad, she had to be hospitalized. Her mom says she asked for a second opinion, but the school district stalled until an attorney got involved. Shiloh Carter.
We were hoping that school districts would start to take this seriously.
She's with Disability Rights Texas and has worked on several cases like Carolinda's. For years, the Texas Education Agency had a target. Only 8.5% of all students could receive special ed. Federal officials said that cap was illegal and ordered Texas to fix the crisis in 2018. But Carter says the effects remain.
We're seeing the same old. You know, this is what school districts were doing before when the cap was in place, kind of trying to deny eligibility and talk parents out of wanting special education services.
In the last 3 years, Texas has barely increased the portion of children who receive services. Less than 10% of students qualify, below the national average of 14.
And I don't think TEA has taken a stance and put pressure on these districts to do that. And so you still have kids falling through the cracks everywhere.
State administrators say they won't catch up until June 2020, but maintain they've made progress. Deputy Education Commissioner Matt Montaño points to more special ed evaluations, more funding, and more communication with districts.
You know, Texas, if you think about Texas as being a large battleship, I do believe we've turned it. I do believe we turned it in the right direction.
He thinks the feds will agree. However, according to emails provided to Houston Public Media and The Chronicle, one regional special ed director indicated the state would give districts a grace period if they failed to comply with all timelines for special ed. As for a response, the TEA says that guidance was misinterpreted and inaccurate. But The Chronicle also found the state hasn't met all the goals it's promised the feds, like extra support to students who were previously denied access or more resources for parents. All that discourages parents like Christina Acevedo.
I can't drop Carolinda off at the school and trust that she's going to be okay.
A feeling shared by many special needs parents in Texas who still have little faith in the state. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee for the Texas Standard.
Laura's story was prepared as a collaboration of Houston Public Media and the Houston Chronicle, which first broke the story of problems with special ed in Texas. We'll have more on the state of special education in the Lone Star State tomorrow. Now, before we leave the issue of education, or Houston for that matter, the largest teachers union in the largest city in Texas is considering joining a lawsuit that would block the Texas Education Agency from replacing the board of the Houston Independent School District. The TEA plans to temporarily strip power from the board's locally elected trustees after chronic low performance at some schools, as well as more than a little internal drama. The Houston Chronicle reports the lawsuit against the TEA was filed by the Board of Trustees. It claims the takeover is a violation of the Voting Rights Act. The Houston Federation of Teachers is expected to make a decision this week over whether to actually join this suit. Heads up, holiday travelers. If you're planning a flight this holiday season, might want to build in a little extra time at the airport than usual. Dallas Morning News reporting December 1st. could be the busiest day ever at DFW. Oh, joy. Based on current bookings, the airport is expecting more than 275,000 passengers on the first day of the last month of 2019. That's a more than 10% increase from a comparable day last year. Why all these delays? Well, remember, this is at a time when Fort Worth-based American Airlines and Dallas-based Southwest are still missing large chunks of their fleets due to the grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX, and that ain't helping things much. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. The sound approach to lung cancer prevention is to avoid smoking and tobacco products while working toward a healthy lifestyle. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at TexasCollegeSavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas's largest archdiocese is challenging a federal rule that provides anti-discrimination protections to LGBT persons. The Archdiocese of Galveston and Houston wants to offer foster care services, but be exempt from federal repercussions if they deny LGBT people service due to what church leaders describe as the sincerely held beliefs of the Catholic Church. It's a move that has representatives of the foster care community in Texas concerned that an already overwhelmed system may lose out on qualified foster parents. Will Francis is the executive director of the Texas chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. Will, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about what this rule is that the Archdiocese is actually challenging here. And I believe they have the Attorney General of Texas in their corner too, right?
Correct. And the Department of Family and Protective Services, which is the agency that oversees child protective services, they are challenging an Obama-era rule that would protect a person from discrimination based on gender identity or sexuality. They feel that to recruit the type of parents that they want to see as foster parents, they have to really be specific to what their values are.
Now, let me just be clear about who would be subject to, who is subject to these rules currently. We're not talking about the children per se. We're talking about, say, adoptive parents.
The reality is it could actually impact both. The Archdiocese is really saying that they want to use this to recruit parents, but were those protections removed, there are concerns that those specific identities of kids, say if they were gay or if they did, say, identify as having some gender identity development, that that would be something that could actually be not respected in the way that it currently is with those protections in place.
I'm sure that you're aware of what the foster care situation currently is. I mean, there have been pretty alarming stories in the press about a chronic shortage of foster care placements and has some kids spending the night in state offices. Question, is more harm than good being done by the existing Obama-era anti-discrimination rule?
No, I think at the end of the day, capacity is sort of the elephant in the room when it comes to your child welfare system. If you don't have enough placements, if you don't have enough family-like settings, then ultimately your kids are going to be either in settings that aren't good enough, they're going to be in large congregate care type settings, or you're going to potentially stick with a placement that you might not need. I think the reality here is we have to be as broad as possible. We have to recruit single parents. We have to recruit same-sex parents. We have to recruit non-traditional families to come into the system. Instead of sort of narrowing in on do you look like what the image of a nuclear family used to look like, we should be as broad as possible in our recruitment. And I think the Obama-era rules allow for that, which essentially says anybody who wants to be part of this, as long as they pass their background checks and receive the correct training, should be part of this system.
On the other hand, I think that the Catholic Church would argue, well, you know, the law shouldn't get in the way of the Catholic Church providing these because, of course, the accommodation for church is also an important First Amendment principle.
And we feel very strongly that the Catholic Church has a very large place in foster care. They've been here for a long time. We really respect their values. Mm-hmm. They can always be at work in the private system. And should they want to work with the state, I think there are ways to essentially highlight what their values are and still not reject families. And that's really where we need to come to the table and sit down. The reality is Texas passed some state laws that allow for exemptions. Mm-hmm. And so there are things in place that the Catholic Church could use to essentially narrow some of their own recruitment. Those are not necessarily laws that we think is maybe the best way to go, but it is here. And so the landscape does allow for that.
This is not entirely unprecedented. South Carolina's governor sought and received a federal exemption from the anti-discrimination rule this year. So I'm wondering how you see this playing out for Texas.
It's interesting. The current presidential administration is much more sympathetic to the lawsuit of this kind. I think they'd like to remove some of these protections. I think that they feel that there should be more leeway allowed to religious organizations as they enter into some of these state systems. So it does seem that there is a potential for a warm response up at the federal level. However, some courts, I believe at least one in Pennsylvania, has already ruled that protection should remain in place. And that ultimately, I think this will go through the court system. And I think that's an important part of it. Additionally, there may be kids or other families who want to join this lawsuit and step in and show how this really could be a barrier to them being part of the system. And I think that would really expand things as well.
Will Francis is executive director of the Texas chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. Thanks so much for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. He's back in the studio, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, that is. What are you hearing from Texans today on social media?
Well, David, buzz about Kanye West's trek across Houston, still hot on social media. As you mentioned earlier in the show, the artist formerly known as Yeezus divided his time between Pastor Joel Osteen's Lakewood Church and two performances for inmates in the Harris County Jail. Right. And also, as you noted, additionally, his wife, Instagram influencer come criminal justice advocate Kim Kardashian, reportedly meeting with Rodney Reed the moment he learned his November 20th execution had been put on hold. So lots to unpack amid Ye's pilgrimage to H-Town. On our Facebook page, Jen Wireman says, performing for prisoners is a good thing. Think Johnny Cash in Folsom Prison. But Christian capitalism doesn't help anything but itself. However, Meg Hertz says, good on him. He's reaching folks in need and reaching for comfort in a way that works for him. However, Joe Gutierrez says this about West's religious rebirth. I've seen it quite too many times when someone finds God and they get all righteous on everyone they meet. They want to climb the highest mountain, the highest roof, to tell the world what they are feeling. I've been there, but just be careful. Don't get too carried away. And you know, that guy, Kanye West.
He's not one to get carried away. He's not one to get carried away.
Tiptoe and dipping his toes into things. So, big weekend out of Houston for him. And I just saw on Pitchfork, he's doing an opera now.
An opera?
Yes. Nebuchadnezzar, named after the Egyptian ruler?
Yeah, probably. Nebuchadnezzar, yes. I think that you may be right, but I'm no scholar.
Someone can probably fact check me right now.
I think that's probably
Texas Standard.
A good idea.
Well, you know, a story that broke as we were just wrapping up Friday, people still talking about as well. Veteran Republican operative and self-described dirty trickster Roger Stone found guilty on all seven counts of false statements and obstruction in his trial, this regarding remarks to Congress about his role in discussing purloined Democratic National Committee emails ultimately released by WikiLeaks during the 2016 presidential election. Remember that? Stone, no stranger to Texas, as he regularly filled in as host on Alex Jones' conspiracy-addled InfoWars program. Yeah, based in Austin. Yeah, he was there in the host chair a few times.
Yep.
Via Facebook, Oscar Estrada says, the so-called witch hunt has produced yet another witch. How about that? Referring there to the president's statements that all this is, you know, so
witch
much
hunt, yeah.
Yeah, so much witch hunting. Stacey Dunlap Cruz says, that Nixon tattoo is going to go over nicely in prison. And if you die, David's chortling. But yeah, Roger Stone has this huge tattoo of Richard Nixon's
tattoo.
Face on his, in between
pretty
his shoulder
amazing.
Blades on his back.
Pretty amazing.
I think
thing.
You can probably see, we're talking about that Netflix documentary you can watch about Roger Stone. Get me
that's
Roger
epic.
Stone.
That's epic. That's a really interesting documentary. I got you some answers from Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh, okay. Yeah, break it down.
Those of you who know the book of Daniel in the Bible, chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4 talk about the conquering King of Babylon who seizes Jerusalem. There we have it. That's Nebuchadnezzar.
Coming to an opera house near you.
There we go. Kanye West working on it. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. And, of course, we'll also be online for those of you who might have to pick us up on podcast. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the team wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam,
and the George Huntington family.